Some weeks after the cessation of hostilities in June of 1967, I took a car and drove from Jerusalem through Bethlehem and Hebron down to Arad and from there to the Dead Sea. It was land in which I had not been before. It was part of a territory called the West Bank, which the Kingdom of Jordan had occupied in 1948. As I drove along, on each side of the road, most of the houses had on their flat roofs a staff, and from that staff there was flying a white bit of cloth. I remember thinking to myself how wonderful if finally the forces of violence have surrendered, peace can be brought, an end to this unnecessary bloodletting. But even as I drove, the car radio brought news of a conference in Khartoum, in Sudan, a conference attended by a number of Arab heads of states, the states which had engaged in the Six-Day War. The summation of that conference was a simple series of negatives. No negotiations, no compromises, no ceasefire. Now, from June of 1967 through the next 20 months or so, there was, in effect, a de facto ceasefire. There were no major activities, at least no consistent activities, between Israel and the neighboring Arab states. Of course, there were nightly incursions of terrorists. There was the daily laying of bombs under buses and in theaters, supermarkets and schools. There was an occasional shelling across the Jordan or across the Dead Sea. There was a daily shelling of some of the settlements in the Baisan Valley across from Jordan. But the ceasefire seemed to have some tenuous hold, and one hoped, and one prayed. And one hoped against hope because daily they were being unloaded at the docks of Alexandria and from the cargo planes which came in to Baghdad, to Damascus and to Cairo. Tons upon tons of sophisticated war equipment to replace the $2 billion of equipment which had been squandered in the June war. The Soviet was undertaking a massive arms lift destined to bring by the early spring of last year to bring the Arab armies up to and to a point far exceeding in military potential, the firepower, the power to kill, which they'd had before. There were now 1,000 supersonic jet planes in the hands of the Arab leaders who had fought against Israel in 1967. And then on May Day, 1969, at a conference of the Arab Socialist Union, General Nasser announced that the time had come to move from the battle of supply to what he called the war of attrition. Let me read to you from that speech. At the beginning of last month, our armed forces said they were prepared. We have been aware and have learned from the statements of Israeli leaders that the Israelis seek complete calm on the front. Therefore, our armed forces have begun to implement their plan. They began implementing it at the beginning of March. The armed forces' objective has been to destroy the Bar-Lev line, Israel's fortifications along the Suez. We are prepared for a long battle to exhaust the enemy. The policy of all Arab states should be to exhaust. A continuous war between us and Israel exists. We have superiority in manpower, but we must mobilize everything for the battle. Brothers, the various stages, as all of you know, have proceeded apace. The stages of active defense, deterrence, attacking the enemy and then crossing the canal from the west to the east bank. As we have said, we are now embarking on the liberation operation. The ceasefire was declared to be a scrap of paper. Israel was declared to be a ready target for any and all Arab attacks, guerrilla, terrorist, or those of the regular Egyptian or Syrian or Jordanian or Iraqi or Saudi Arabian armies. And the war was escalated by the Egyptians day by day. And with more sorties, more frogmen, more bombs, more cannonading, and more terrorists. And very shortly, Israel was accepting, that's the fumigated military word, was receiving 50 casualties a week, a number of casualties which, if we extrapolated them from the size of the population, would mean that the United States would be suffering 5,000 casualties a week in Vietnam. Now, the diplomats of the world listened to Mr. Nasser, and they heard him speak of a war of liberation, of the scrapping of the ceasefire, of a battle of attrition. But because they were, especially the diplomats of the West, hung on the horns of a dilemma, which is spelt by three little letters, O-I-L, oil, the diplomats of the world proposed that what Mr. Nasser was really saying was that Egypt had undertaken to move ahead the timetable which would force Israel to pull back, to roll back from the land which her armies had overrun 2 years before. And what he wanted to do was hasten the day when the effect, the disastrous effect for him, of the June war could be undone and one could revert to the status quo ante, to the conditions that the Near East had been in the spring of 1967. Reading Mr. Nasser to speak in those limited terms, they felt there was reason for hope. There could be negotiations. There was a basis for compromise. And that the United Nations, Big Four meetings, through Ambassador Yaring, all kinds of proposals were made again and again. Timetables were drawn up. There were arrangements as to who would say what to whom when, what needed to be done before Israel would pull back, what agreements had to be made by the Arab states. But each of these proposals was met by adamant silence and opposition by the Arab states, by General Nasser. None seemed to suit his need, because ultimately what he was saying was that the diplomats had misread his intentions. The war of liberation was no more and no less than a war of liquidation. And that what he had in mind and the Arabs who fought with him had proposed and had decided on was that nothing would be acceptable to them short of a Middle East in which Israel would no longer exist as a sovereign state. And so it would seem to be a relatively easy matter to agree to the legitimacy of the sovereignty of one's neighbor. And Israel, having said again and again in those intervening years that beyond this there is no issue which cannot be negotiated, though it would seem that there is room and basis for compromise, in fact, no adjustment, no meeting, no negotiations could take place, because that which the Arabs insist upon as the basis of a settlement, the dismemberment of Israel, the destruction of the state, could not, of course, be accepted by Israel, for it meant not only the end of her existence, but the lives of 2.25 million of her people. And so we saw during the two intervening years from 67 through 69, a frenzied series of fervent diplomatic efforts designed to diffuse the growing pace and rate of fighting in the Middle East, all of these coming to naught, all of these ending abruptly in the late spring of 1969, when Nasser said, "We have moved beyond any attempt by us to gain diplomatically what we insist upon. We will now gain it by war, and we are ready." Those of us who read rather carefully Al-Aram, particularly Mr. Haikal, his editor, who's often the spokesman of General Nasser, particularly the Israeli Foreign Office, who reads him with great care, understood precisely what the Egyptians had in mind. They would take what they could get by negotiation at an arm's length, if they didn't have to negotiate. If the West, if Russia could force Israel to roll back, so much the better. Their tanks, their planes would be that much closer to Jerusalem and to Haifa and Tel Aviv. And if the West could be moved to apply economic sanctions to Israel, so much the better. That would ultimately make the military task, the ultimate task, that much easier. Diplomacy was a tactic of their ultimate strategy. So their strategy was to weaken Israel, to gain some military advantage, to bleed Israel, and ultimately to force the final battle and her destruction. And so we saw, beginning in that spring a year ago, a beginning of an escalation of attack, a beginning of an escalation of violence to which Israel then was forced to make a response. What was that response? After great soul searching, that response was to meet violence with violence, to meet attack with attack, not to be a punching bag, to be bled at will by the Arab state. But if they proposed to attack Israel by land, Israel would attack Egypt, particularly by air, and would expose the weakness and the pretense of the Arab world. Hopefully, they could shake the Arab leaders, or perhaps shake the Arab people, into an acceptance of the status quo, into an acceptance of the ultimate fact that Israel exists and will be. So we saw over the last year a growing crescendo of violence. It was not a violence which Israel undertook willingly or easily. As you read the Israeli press, you knew that there was great soul-searching. Mrs. Meir, when she was here in the United States, said something which revealed the heartache which was going on in Israel. She said that the only thing which she could not forgive Mr. Nasser was that he was forcing Israeli young men and young women to kill. It's not our métier. We're a peaceful people. We ask only to live, and we propose to let live. But there was no other alternative. Ein Barrera. What else could be done? Oh, there were proposals. There were some who said, let Israel make some major concession, without some assurance by the Arab states that that would be the end of it, that they would then meet and they would then come to some compromise agreement. Let Israel roll back as she did in 56, and then all would be well. But there was no agreement to this from the Arab world. There was every reason to believe that if Israel pulled back, the Arabs would simply increase their demands. When the prey is blooded, the predator senses the kill and moves in even faster. And there were men who said, but at least you would win if you pulled back now without any assurance of the future. You would win the goodwill of the world. And the Israelis were reading the headlines of the world. And they were reading how the Czechs, the Dubček, had won the goodwill of the world by destroying the opportunity for freedom which he represented. They were reading about Biafra, which again had the goodwill of the world. But how much good had the goodwill of the world done either of these countries in their moment of ultimate need? And there were some sensitive, some romantics who said, well, why doesn't Israel simply turn the other cheek? Isn't the best way to respond to violence to be non-violent? Is it? 6 million of our people were non-violent, and they walked to their death. No Nazi guard, no Gauleiter, Hitler or Himmler is ever known to have had his hunger, his bloodlust assuaged by the passivity, the non-violence of the 6 million. Stalin is not known to have reduced his level of violence because of those who were in the Siberian concentration camps did not protest their exile. Yes, nonviolence worked in India. It worked for Mr. Gandhi. But it worked in India because economically and politically, England had already decided that India was not worth the holding, could not be held. He simply catalyzed what would otherwise have been inevitable. But it is not otherwise inevitable that the Arabs accept the existence of Israel. That is the very thing they will not accept. The nonviolence of the Israelis, their non-response, would mean only that the Arabs would crowd them further and further. The issue would become ever more desperate. You know, our faith is a remarkably realistic one. We love peace. We've never been pacifists. We want always to enlarge the peacefulness of human relations, our ability to get along, to make out, and to make do. But at the same time, we will not allow the pathological and the criminal simply to tread on us. If a man comes to kill you, kill him beforehand. When evil exists in the world and is abroad in the world, viarta haga, burn out the evil. Don't simply let it burn you and your house and your synagogue down. There is a point beyond which man cannot be crowded. There is a point beyond which passivity and nonviolence is suicide. And the first rule of life is to survive. The next rule is to have peace. Now the Israelis said, and said it again and again, there can be a return to peace at this moment, today, tomorrow. All the Arab states have to do is to respect the ceasefire, and we will in turn respect it. And Mrs. Mayer said to the world, as she said 2 months ago and 10 months ago and a year ago, the moment the Arab states decide that the ceasefire line is binding on both sides, there will be no more bombings by us. The moment that Nasser, Hussein, Syria, and Lebanon agree, even before they are ready to make peace, that the ceasefire line obliges both sides, there should be quiet on both sides, then no planes, no firing, and nothing else will go from our side to the other side. Israel asks only that the ceasefire be respected, and she will respect it. The violence continues. The Arab world remains adamant. Israel increasingly, because of this policy of retaliation, seems to be, in the words which have become familiar in the press, military-minded, belligerent. She is not. She did not ask to be put into this bind. The one thing she will not be is a victim. What else can she do? What else would we have her do? Now, there are mistakes. There's a terrible tragedy a week ago when a plane bombed an iron and steel plant near Helwan. But I would remind you that in terms of supersonic aircraft, the distance between the military target and this steel mill was a matter of some 2 seconds. There are mistakes. Violence was brought to Israel. Israel did not initiate the violence. And Israel is prepared to withhold any response if only she will be allowed peace, if only the ceasefire can be re-established. Now, the situation has changed in the last few months because of the Israeli response. The Israeli Air Force has exposed for all to see the weakness of the Arab position. Nasser, Mr. Haykel, may think of taking an attack across the canal of bleeding the Israeli army, but the Air Force and the army have shown that they are strong, not weak, that it is the Egyptians for all of their planes who are the weaker. And they have been able to have complete command of the skies and to bomb military and targets in the United Arab Republic almost as will. They have been able to pull out by a form of incredible military surgery the various radar and missile sites which were raised against them. And the whole policy of being able to unleash a war of attack which Nasser proclaimed a year ago has been shown up to be that which Nasser tends to be an expert at, a strategy based on hot air. So at this point in time, the Arab states have reverted to diplomacy, to pressure, to propaganda. And their attack against Israel is now being prosecuted and will be for the next few months until her air force is rebuilt, until the French planes to Libya can be brought into the Egyptian Air Force and brought into operation, until new supplies can be brought and hopefully the Soviet brought in. For this moment in time, the Arab attack is being waged by terror and by diplomacy. And what essentially has happened is that the members of those companies which have oil rights and commercial rights and business interests in the various parts of the Arab world, but particularly the oil companies and the banks who hold their paper, have been called in by their various governments and privately informed that all the millions of dollars which they have invested in the new Egyptian oil fields and the vast resources of Libya, all these are in jeopardy if they do not force the United States to what is euphemistically called a more even-handed policy. And by this, the Arab states mean, in the first instance, an end of the sale of Phantom jets to Israel, so that as her air force is increased by the MiG-21s and the MiG-23s and the various other planes being sent by the Soviet, Israel has no deterrent weapon. And in the second instance, by an end to the kinds of other military sales and financial support which the United States or citizens of the United States have been able to offer Israel at this moment in time. We saw the first public evidence of this in December, in early December of 1969, when Mr. David Rockefeller of the Chase National Bank, which holds the major loans of Standard Oil in New Jersey, and the former Secretary of Treasury of the Eisenhower administration, Mr. Raymond Anderson, who was one of the senior officers of Dresser Industries, the major American investor in the new Egyptian oil fields, and other men of this status and economic position in our society, went to the White House and pleaded with Mr. Nixon to use all of the skills and powers at his disposal to bring an end to the tensions in which they were being caught. Because the American policy of insisting on a package deal to end the results of the conflict of 1967, to live up to the negotiations required by the UN in November of 1967, and the United States' position of friendship and of concern for the Israeli democracy had put them in a most financially embarrassing position. The very next day, Secretary of State Rogers announced that the United States had submitted a new initiative to the Big Four, and in that initiative, as it later developed, a number of the points on which the United States had hitherto insisted, freedom of passage through the Suez, a specific timetable, and so on, seemed to have been fudged or omitted. The United States' position was weakened. Now, this pressure on the oil companies and on the banks has increased in the last 6 weeks. Just this week, some of you may have seen a very interesting report which appeared on the financial pages of the New York Times, which was edited by a man named William D. Smith, in which he talks of the concern of U.S. oil men about the Mideast situation. I'd read you a few paragraphs. It's rather fascinating. Middle East experts, he writes, for the major oil companies are convinced that the political situation in the Arab world is more critical than any time since the 1967 war. They believe that the Arabs have become far too sophisticated to cut off oil supplies, except in the most extreme instances, but they are quick to add This only holds true if everything remains rational. If the Arabs are pushed too far by Israel, then it will be burn, baby, burn, even if it means destroying their own economies. Now, what they mean by Israel pushing the Arab world too far is unclear. Obviously, what they mean is if Israel insists on retaliating to Arab attack. Most of the oil men, he continues, are convinced that the present increase in hostilities and the growing anti-American sentiment can be explained in one word, the phantoms. And then he goes on to talk of the pressures which they are bringing privately and publicly against the State Department and the Defense Department to preclude the further sale of these phantoms. Many oil men, one writes, this man says, are still bitter about this kind of criticism. One said to me bitterly, this is a quote, "A handful of men go to Washington to plead for a foreign policy they sincerely believe is for the best interest of the United States, and they are reviled and berated." He's talking of the reaction to the Rockefeller presentation. "Hundreds go down to present the Israeli case, and they are depicted as humanitarians. Arab lives don't count, it would appear. What counts, obviously, are tens of millions of dollars of oil rigs and military and industrial investment." So we're going to see in the weeks ahead a growing pressure raised against our own government by many of the interests who finance the election of this government, a growing pressure to force the United States from the position of support which she has shown to Israel on two counts. The first, her insistence that there must be some rational approach to peace in the Middle East. Whereas the Soviet has been the simple-minded, single-minded protagonist of the Arab cause and has seen to it that anything that Nasser wants, he gets in the UN or out. Though they have supplied the Arab world with vast quantities of the most sophisticated weapons, though France has shown herself to be willing to sell her soul and her planes to any government except Israel under any pretense, as long as bullion flows into the French coffers, the United States has insisted that there must be some lasting solution to the problems of the Middle East. That we cannot go on year after year, decade after decade, living with this kind of tension. And that the only kind of rational solution is one in which the parties sit down and work out an agreement. The only rational situation can be one in which they all, at the very least, recognize the legitimacy of one another. That's United States policy. But it's a policy which gets in the way of Arab principles and Arab ambitions, and so is bitterly attacked in the Arab capitals. And as part of this policy, the United States has in the last 2 years been willing to sell a number, relatively few actually, 50, 75 Phantom jets to Israel as a deterrent weapon because of the hundreds upon hundreds of MiGs which have been sold to the Arab states. There must be some balance of force. And of course, this the Arabs cannot tolerate. And it is this balance of force, this willingness of the United States not to give, but to sell to a nation which will defend herself, a free nation which will defend her own freedom. It is this willingness of the United States to sell these planes which the oil lobbies and the banking lobbies and the other commercial lobbies are now attacking in the name of, quote, a more even-handed policy. What more even-handed policy could the United States have than she has now? She has actually sent in the last 20 years more millions of dollars of aid to Egypt than to Israel. She has sent in the last 20 years more military and economic aid to Jordan than to Israel. Is it not even-handed to insist that there be some even give and take? It would not be simply from Israel that there are matters taken, land and supply and support and the ability to survive. The United States government has so far held firm. The United States government has so far seen that Ultimately, the needs of the United States, the long-range political needs, require peace in the Middle East. We pray that she will. But we are moving into tense political times. We will see, I am afraid, in our public press, a barrage of stories, planted, paid for, and otherwise, which talk of the so-called legitimacy of the Arab cause, which seem to paint the terrorists as liberation fighters, which seem to talk of the dispassionately of American political needs as if the only political need America has throughout the world is to sustain the commercial investment of oil peoples. We will see to it that those who traditionally dislike Israel, which has today become a euphemism for Jew, we will see that these people are now heard and insisting that it is the pound of flesh that is cut from the Israeli nation without any give or any take from the other side. We will have to be strong and we will have to be understanding, and each of us has a responsibility to know and to understand and to correct our neighbors and to correct the public media and to correct misapprehension when in fact they exist. And much will be demanded of us in terms of our substance, in terms of our support. But that's for another time and another place. Will there be peace in the Middle East? Not in the near future. The Arab world reminds me of a child having a temper tantrum. You can't reason with it. You can sometimes slap sense into it. But reason, common sense, good sense, simply doesn't penetrate. The Arab world is busy convincing itself that it has the legitimate right, the moral duty, the religious obligation to destroy the state of Israel. Jihad, the ultimate anomaly, a holy war. And the Arab world, or at least its leadership and those who feed its mass media, are busy convincing themselves that this is the ultimate holy cause. One cannot argue with such passion. One cannot argue with a mob. A mob has lost its ability to reason. A mob responds, and a mob must be controlled. Israel has no short-term opportunity save to maintain by strength her legitimacy and her borders. But you know, the Arab world is very mistaken on this. They believe that time is in the long run working to their benefit. It is not. They like to hark back to the Crusades. Nasser talks constantly of the Crusades, of the Hundred Years' War. He likes to say that, yes, Europe came to the Middle East, and there was a Christian Jerusalem kingdom for 50 years, and ultimately the Arabs took the kingdoms of Jerusalem and Antioch and Acre and Baalbek, Croc, and reconquered them. It was only a matter of time. History doesn't repeat itself. The analogy is false. The Crusaders were Europeans who served a tour of duty a few years and then returned to Europe. The Israelis are of the Middle East. This is their home. There is no place to return to, no place to go to. This is the last stand. It is false in many counts. It was not the Arabs who reconquered the Arab world from the Christians, but the Seljuks, outsiders, Turks. The Arab world never came back into its own until late in the 20th century, 800 years later. But more than this, in the next years, Israel is a state which will move from scientific achievement to scientific achievement, from technological advance to technological advance. And the Arab states have bankrupted their social revolution in order to carry on this futile and feckless war. I read someplace just recently that Israel now represents the 16th state among the 100 and some odd countries of the world in terms of the wealth invested in each citizen if you measure it against the gross national product. Israel represents the only underdeveloped nation from the period before the Second World War which has become a modern, advanced, and technologically sophisticated state. And anything they can do, Israel can ultimately do better. It's a matter of brains, it's a matter of schools, it's a matter of the whole complex of a culture and of a society. Nasser said himself just 2 weeks ago in his interview with Mr. Reston and others, that so many elements of the social revolution in Egypt had to be sacrificed in order to wage war against Israel. He might have added that much had been sacrificed in order to wage war against Arabs in the Yemen and Arabs in the and blacks in the Sudan, but that's another story. The point is that in Egypt and in Syria and in Iraq and in Jordan, the nations have not advanced socially over where they were 20 years ago. The point is that the gap between skill and limited skill, between the 20th century and a pre-industrial society, or a society just beginning its industrialization, is growing apace day by day and year by year. And ultimately, Israel will have, although she doesn't really want it, the capacity to be self-sufficient in arms and planes and all the things that her defense will require. Yes, there will be fighting, I'm afraid. But the Arab world is not united on this one point. And she cannot count on her one support, the Soviet, endlessly. The Soviet has other chestnuts in the fire, other concerns, particularly a rather large concern on her eastern border with China. And the Arab world, as was revealed at the conference of Rabat, is not similarly involved in this Israeli imbroglio. The states of the Maghreb of the West and North Africa have their other interests. The very existence of Libya as a part of the United Arab Republic, as an Egyptian suzerainty in effect, is causing tension with Algeria, which looks upon Libya as part of her sphere of influence. Arab is fighting against Arab in the Jordan. Arab is fighting against Arab in Iraq, Kurd against Ba'ath government. There's violent ideological and personal difference between the Ba'ath governments of Syria and Iraq and the Nasserite governments in Egypt and the Sudan and Libya. The Arab world is poor. It is bankrupting itself commercially to the Soviet Union in order to purchase these arms. It is selling its rice crop, its cotton crop for years ahead against the arms it is misusing today. Israel, of course, is paying a price. But so are the Arab states. Hopefully, the shoe will pinch sufficiently hard that some sense, some common sense, will be shocked into the system of these countries before the bloodbath goes much further. Will there be peace in the Middle East? Will there be peace in our world? No one can say for sure. Ultimately, there will be peace. And when that peace comes, Israel will exist. But there will be many a crisis before that day. There'll be many a problem to meet. And you and I, and all who believe themselves to be part of this household of Israel, have a unique responsibility in the days and weeks ahead. Because much depends upon us. Much depends upon our strength and our steadiness and our conviction. Let me put it another way. Much depends on our understanding and our willingness to commit ourselves and to put what we have, in a sense, on the line for the future of our people. It's more than for the future of our people. Israel is one of the last chances in our world for it to prove out the case that might does not make right, that freedom has a chance to explode and to explore and to be secure. You know, the lights of freedom have been going out throughout the world. The Czechs lost. The Greek Democrats lost. The Biafrans lost.
throughout Africa and Latin America, the junta, the military dictatorship, has more and more come to the fore and taken over more and more countries. Can a free people survive? I think so, if we make it possible. Can free institutions be retained and be made secure? I believe so, if we're willing to work at it, to give of ourselves even as Israel gives of its lives. Can the small free nation of the world, which was devoted to the rehabilitation of one of the great historical traditions of the world, can a Jewish state born on the ashes of the Holocaust survive? I pray so. I believe so. But it's up to us. It will not happen by a miracle. None of the great states of the world will see to it. Ultimately depends on us, this people Israel. Now, over the long centuries in their worship services, our people spoke a confession of faith. One of the articles of this confession said, Anima Amin Be'emunah Shleima Viet HaMashiach Afal Pi Shayit Mamea Achakelo. I believe with perfect faith in the coming of a Messiah, in the possibilities of life, and even though these are delayed, I will await them. I will believe. We stand as our people have always stood, awaiting and believing. Anim, amin. I believe. Amen.